Now, the number that shows up on my phone.
Okay, today is Friday, September 16th, 2011. This is Brennan Berg at the University of Texas at Austin and the H. J. Luther Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports and the Institute for Olympic Studies. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing Debbie Meyer over the phone about her experience in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. So, Debbie, just to start off, can you just give us real quickly your birth name and when and where you were born?
Deborah Elizabeth Meyer, and I was born at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland.
Okay. And just to get started, can you just discuss your childhood and particularly, you know, how you got involved in athletics and maybe what influenced you to get involved in athletics?
Well, I'm the second of four kids, the only girl, and growing up, I grew up first couple years, three or four years or so of my life in Maryland, and, you know, learned to swim in the Chesapeake Bay and Severn River, as my parents, both my parents' families are from there. I never took a swimming lesson in my life. My mother was a swim teacher during the summers when she was in high school and college. She was also a physical education teacher. My father swam in high school, played lacrosse at University of Maryland. And, you know, they were very athletic, very always on the go, very physical and, you know, just in being active. And my older brother is an older brother. You know, I followed him around. I wanted to do what he did. And then when my dad was recruited out of grad school, we moved from Maryland to New Jersey, and he started working for Campbell Soup. And one summer we became members of a summer club, and one of the first days that we were members, they had a potluck Wednesday night races, and I saw some kids racing, and I asked my parents if I could do that. I was on the team the next day. Basically, all I knew how to do was swim underwater and swim freestyle, but you know, I learned the other strokes on the swim team, and kind of just took off from there. I was 7.5 years old, almost 8, and just started swimming. I was always a tomboy, loved playing sports. I remember I played lip league, and I got through 3 games before somebody found out I was a girl, and I got kicked off, and that was in 1960. So there were, you know, many options for girls to play sports at that time. We played, I couldn't play softball on an organized team. You weren't allowed until you were in sixth grade. And, you know, I just played with my brother. I played baseball with my brother. I played football with my brothers. I played ice hockey. I did ice skating for a while, but then when it came to doing shows with fufu outfits, I bowed out. That just was not me. So, and to this day, I ski, I swim, I play golf. I, you know, I just like being athletic.
Okay. Well, great. Well, you in '68, you were 16 years old. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, obviously a young age to be in the Olympics. So, you know, what was that like of, you know, being so young? I mean, the lead up, let's start with the lead up to Mexico City. I mean, just realizing at such a young age that you were going to be going to the Olympics. I mean, how did you, you know, reach that point, and what was that like for you?
Well, the odd thing is 4 years prior to Mexico City, I had no clue what the Olympics were. I got a stopwatch for Christmas from my parents, and it said, Debbie Meyer, December 25th, 1964, on the back, and in quotations, it said Mexico City. And I had to ask them what it meant, because I had no clue. And, you know, the end of the conversation was, well, maybe you can get there someday. So that Christmas, I We also found out we were moving from New Jersey to Sacramento because my dad was transferred with Campbell Soup. And I was really worried they wouldn't have a swim team because I was only swimming, you know, from Memorial Day to Labor Day in the summertime and then 3 months in the winter at the Camden Y. So, you know, I was not a year-round swimmer. I could not break 30 seconds for a 50-yard freestyle. I couldn't go maybe more than 500 yards, 500 meters per practice, which was like an hour long with a bunch of other girls, like 40 other girls. So it was kind of an awesome ride. It was real quick, real fast, and furious. And once we got to Arden Hills and moved to Sacramento, and I started swimming with Sherm Shavor, who happened to be the 1968 and 72 Olympic coach and the 67 Pan Am coach, I was not in his guide. Started off in his group the very first practice and lasted about 5 minutes. And I actually got out and walked away from the pool because they were much too fast for me. I didn't know anybody. You know, it's just one of those things. You're 12 and a half years old and you move across country and you don't know anybody. And you're very self-conscious of who you are, how you perform, and things like that. So I got home, back to the hotel where we were staying, and my mom, you know, just said, well, what are you going to do? I said, I don't think this is the right swim team for me. I don't know if I'm going to do it. She asked me, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know, watch TV. Wrong answer. So I made up my mind to try it again the next day, and I kept trying and trying, and I finally made an entire practice, you know, without stopping after about 2 to 3 months. I went from doing, you know, 100 yards to doing 5,000 yards a day in practice. So I eventually got moved back up to Sherm's group and just, you know, set goals for myself that I didn't really realize I was goal setting at that time. You know, that was not a big buzzword then. It was, you know, just, you know, do your best, swim your hardest. And I got absolute awesome, you know, support from my parents. And they said, if you ever decide to quit, it's always your decision. It's not ours. You're the one that's swimming. So, you know, I just kept setting goals. And Sherm, my coach, actually did most of the setting. He said, okay, we're going to do this this year. This is the time we're shooting for and all of this. So after my first year at Arden Hills, I made the Nationals, which, you know, was a pretty big quantum leap from not breaking 30 seconds to going to a national championships. So that was in, we moved out in 65, and I made my first indoors in April of 66, a year later. So, and then it just, I just kept climbing rung by rung up the ladder and working hard. And that's one of the things my parents always instilled in our family is, you know, put your best foot forward and work hard. And if you get into a roadblock, just, you know, take a step back and figure out how you're going to get through that roadblock.
Okay. Well, with a lot of Olympic athletes, we often hear just about how intense the training is and how time consuming it is. So just at that age you were leading up to 68, I mean, was it really just going to school during the day and a lot of training?
Eat, sleep, and swim. Go to school during the school year. But that's what I wanted. That was my choice. You know, I had every opportunity to get out of it, but I wanted to do that. And I knew if I was going to do anything and be successful, and even 2 years before the Olympics, I had no clue that I would even have a chance of making the Olympic trials. You know, I knew that I had to work hard. And, you know, everybody has a choice. And, yes, it is intense, and you know it going into it. But, you know, I was fine with that.
So were a lot of your friends, would you say, mostly just also elite swimmers as well?
Most of my friends were on the swim team, yes, because I spent most of my time there.
Right.
You know, when you're in high school and in middle school, it was junior school when I went, you know, you spend half an hour maybe in a classroom with them or 40 minutes, and you may only be in that one class with room with them all day or 10 minutes in your homeroom or however long it is. I did have two really good friends in high school. So, you know, the majority were athletes, yes.
Okay. Well, just describe now the, you know, the closer to the Olympics of actually making the team. I mean, was it a trial or a major competition? I mean, what, just that specific moment where you realized, wow, I'm going to Mexico City. I mean, just what was that like for you and those around you?
Well, I think the first time I had an inkling that I had a chance to make it to the Games was in 1967 when I made the Pan American Games. And actually, it was probably January before that when I broke an American record in the 1650 freestyle, which is a yard event and not a meter event like in the Pan Ams and the Olympic Games. And I just thought, wow, I may have a chance to do this. So I just kept working harder and harder. And, you know, I'd follow the Swimming World magazine that came out every month with everybody's rankings to see what, you know, other girls from around the country were doing in those events and things like that. And, you know, my goal was just to get faster at that point in time. And the summer after the Pan Games and after the Nationals in 1967 in Philadelphia, I really need to do have a chance. You know, hearing about what the Olympics were, that, you know, every 4 years and the whole background of it. And I worked really hard so I could. The times that my coach had set as goals. And unfortunately, six or 8 weeks prior to the Olympic trials, I ended up getting bursitis in my shoulder. And I had to scratch a 1500 at the Santa Clara International Meet because I couldn't lift my arm up. And I just bawled. I just broke down because I had to scratch the event. I couldn't swim in. I was extremely upset. Because I thought, oh gosh, there go my dreams. And so I ended up resting it for 3 weeks, taking some medication, anti-inflammatories, and putting, you know, just kicking, just doing kicking work, not using my arm. Or if I did swim, I'd only swim with my left arm, not my right arm that hurt. So it was a touch-and-go situation because when I got back in the water, you know, it was still sore, it still hurt, but it wasn't the pain like I had before. And, you know, obviously it turned out okay. I made the Olympic team. I set 3 world records in the process of making the team and then going on to training academy. We had training center or training camp. We were allowed by the International Olympic Committee to go and train at altitude just for 1 month prior to the games so people could get acclimated to swimming in altitude. Well, it worked out that I ended up my shoulder hurting again prior up at training camp, and I couldn't take any type of medicine, so the only thing I could take was aspirin. So I was taking like 4 aspirin every 4 hours, and it just, you know, to try and get the inflammation down. And it worked, and the rest, I guess you could say, is history.
Yeah. Well, you've already noted just the support you had from your family. I mean, just were the people around you.
Pardon me, I didn't hear that. The phone kind of jigged right here.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, you've already noted the support you got from, like, your family. And just when you also just realized you were going to the Olympics, I mean, were they and just the people around you, like at school or other friends, were, I mean, was it just such a great reaction, and was everyone just really excited for you?
Well, you know, the Olympics back then are not like the Olympics today. It we didn't have the 365 hours of coverage that they have today. I'm not sure exactly what they had in Mexico City. I know it was the first time it was televised live. And I know prior to that in 64, you know, they would tape them in Tokyo, put the film on a jet, and send it to L.A., and it was broadcast, you know, for maybe an hour in the evening, if that. So it was nothing like they have today. So, you know, it was something that was thought of only once every 4 years. And even then, the hype was not great. The one thing that did, you know, kind of put it on the map a little bit is Life magazine followed me around for a month or two. You know, they followed me prior to the Olympic trials, and then they followed me at the training camp, and then they followed me around in Mexico City itself. So, you know, my friends would say congratulations and stuff, but, you know, I was extremely shy then. I was extremely introverted. I hated seeing my picture in the paper. I hated doing interviews. So, you know, and most of my friends knew this, so they just said, hey, nice going at the swim meet type thing, which was great for me.
Okay, that's very interesting. Well, you mentioned altitude training, and that's come up a lot with, just all the Olympians from the 68 games. So was that something that proved to be very effective in Mexico City?
You know, in 1967, I went to Albuquerque with Dr. Goddard, and they were doing, you know, some tests on athletes. Myself, Mike Burton, a friend of mine that was on Arden Hills that also made the Olympic team and won 2 gold medals in Mexico and then a repeat in 1500 in Munich. And he, Mike and I, and a couple more teammates from my team were there, and we did the testing with Dr. Goddard along with one or two other swimmers across the country. And I always thought it was for, you know, Mexico City. And it was actually for the space program. And it wasn't until, you know, years later that I found that out. I was probably told that, but, I, you know, at 16, do you pay attention to that stuff? I sure didn't. So that was pretty interesting. We did go down to Mexico in October, a year before the games, to what they called the Little Olympics to find out if, you know, how much altitude was going to affect the athletes. Time-wise, when you're peaked and shaved, yes, it did, especially for the distance people. Some events it did, some events it did not. But I grew up with asthma. I knew what it was like not to have air.
Oh, okay. Well, that is important, yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
And another thing is that, you know, we were all under the same boat.
Right.
Everybody was, you know, competing under the same conditions. Yes, it helps to have altitude, you know, training before, so you can be acclimated to the feeling of being out of breath. You know, it does take a couple weeks to get used to that. So, I think it was beneficial. The East Germans and the Russians, you know, obviously did not adhere to the IOC's, you know, instructions that you get 1 month of training, because they moved their entire team to a permanent address at altitude, you know, a year before. Didn't help them much, but, you know, because we dominated everything. But I know for a fact that, you know, I think it helped the swimmers, and it probably helped the track athletes a little bit.
Okay. Well, certainly the 68 Olympics just had a lot of different socio-political issues surrounding it. And so we'll start touching on some of those here in the next couple of questions. But the Olympic Project for Human Rights was something that some of the U.S. Olympians knew about, because the Harvard crew team sent out a letter in support of just the civil rights movement and discussing possible
apartheid in South America and everything in South Africa and all. Yeah,
right. And just talking about possible boycotts or political action. I mean, just was that something you heard about or even paid any attention to at that point?
Well, I don't remember if I heard about it or not, but that was the difference between a sophomore in high school and a college athlete.
Right.
Yeah. You know, there's a big age difference there, and I think the crew team was probably in their 20s, because I know a couple people on the crew team, the Livingston brothers, their parents lived in Sacramento, so they came back with us, and, they were much older than we were. So, I was a teenage girl, that led a very sheltered life. I'd get up in the morning, go to practice, go to school, come home, go to practice, do my homework, and go to bed. So, obviously, I didn't watch the news a whole lot because I was either in the water or doing my homework. I would catch snippets here and there and read, glance through the paper, but I think at that point in my life, I was glancing at the sports page more than anything.
Yeah.
So, as far as a social life, I had my social life in the swimming pool, and that's what I wanted. But world news, the biggest thing in our papers that, I would catch would be the Vietnam War. That was the biggest headline every single day in the paper.
Yeah.
This, obviously, with Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King, yes, that was in the paper as well, but not always on the front page. And, I was aware of the situation. And, I got caught in D.C. in his I Have a Dream march. I was coming home from Virginia visiting my grandparents because they had just moved back from Panama. And they were living in Alexandria at the time. And we were on our way back to, Annapolis to my other group, to my aunt's house, so, my parents could come down and pick me up and make a switch and stuff. And we got caught in the march, and, it was a surreal thing, believe me. But, I was 12 at the time. I didn't understand what was going on.
Okay, that's very interesting. So when you were in Mexico City, those Olympics were also noted for 10 days before the game started. There was student protests and a lot of violence. Did you see any aftermath of that while you were at the Olympics or walking around the village?
The only aftermath we saw were M16s.
Okay.
The National Army everywhere. I can remember sitting at our motel in Colorado Springs watching Huntley Brinkley, I guess it was, talking about the possibility of canceling the games. And it just floored me, absolutely floored me. And I thought, no way, we've worked so hard. And we were told that it was just student unrest and that 300 students were injured. Well, in 08, I went back for a 40-year reunion to Mexico City, and I had never been back since then. It was myself, Mike Burton, Michael Webden, Dick Fosbury, and Smith and Carlos were there on another trip, but we got together, and they were involved in the reunion as well. And we went to the village, and one of the reporters that was doing a story from France on Dick Fosbury, his uncle-in-law was a student at that time, and his cousin-in-law is, his wife's two uncles, I guess, were involved in it, and he got the whole story you know, long before it came out in the paper that 3,000 students were killed, and that they, you know, the army came in and they picked the bodies up, put them in dump trucks, took them out to the beach, put them in Hueys, and dumped them in the ocean. And this did not come out until like 30 years after the Olympic Games. You know, people did know about it, but it officially came out through the government that that's what happened. And the students were upset because the country was spending all this money on the Olympics and not on education for the mass population. So it just, you know, I was aghast when I actually saw pictures of it and heard about it.
Hmm. Okay, well, so, yeah, you described the high security there. What were your other impressions of Mexico City? Did you get to go out doing any sightseeing or go to other Olympic events?
I did sightseeing afterwards. We went to some things at the embassy there, some parties. We saw Folkloria. Our events were the second week of the Olympics. We got there a week before, and then the first week, or maybe 3 or 4 days before the Olympics began. I can't remember exactly, because we were on a chartered flight. Otherwise, I would have saved my ticket. So we arrived, I think, 5 days before the Olympics started. So we had an opportunity to do a few things, not much sightseeing. But there was some sightseeing in the village, because when they built the village, they had uncovered some ruins and pyramids and stuff. So we got to see those. It was after the games that I did get to sightsee. The Life magazine people left after following me around, and they left their driver with my mom and dad, who came down to watch me swim. And so we got to sightsee for 3 days after I finished swimming before the closing ceremonies and leaving. So that was kind of cool. And, you know, going into the small little towns and experiencing hot sauce for the first time and you know, things like that. Because Mexican food was not big. It was big in California, but it was Americanized Mexican food.
Right.
And so being down there, you know, we actually did do. And I wasn't much of a sightseer, even when I went to Europe before my first trip. They took a sightseeing. I'm going, why do I want to look at an old building? You know, I didn't appreciate it at that point in time.
Hmm.
I had homework to do.
What were your overall impressions of just the accommodations there, from the village to the event venues and the athletic facilities and the food? I mean, just was all that good for you?
You know, I think they did an okay job, because they had different cafeterias. You know, the people, the westernized people, like the English, the Australians, the Americans, the Canadians, we all ate together because our food was fixed similarly. And, you know, the Asians ate together, like the Japanese, the Indonesians, the Koreans, I guess, and, you know, they all ate together because they ate similar foods. You know, I thought it was okay. We were warned not to drink the water. We were warned, you know, not to eat the vegetables because they were all rinsed in the water and things like that. Everybody was afraid of getting Montezuma's revenge. And I ended up getting it anyway. And I 5 o'clock one morning, I woke up and boom, it was the morning of the 800 trials and the finals of the 200 freestyle. And I was sicker than a dog, but, you know, I made it through it. I, you know, pulled up as much as I could from the inside and muscled my way through it and mentally made it through it. And I was okay by the finals. I was not the best. I probably dropped about 3 or 4 to 5 pounds, and it just, you know, and then I found out why. You know, they brought in these big water jugs, you know, for us to drink out of purified water. Well, after the first one was emptied, I was walking back to the women's section of the village. We were cordoned off by, you know, barbed wire and guards and everything else because men were not allowed in our buildings. And I saw one of the workers filling up one of the water jugs from a tap outside the building. So, you know, that's why a lot of people were getting sick. And then, you know, I had an okay room. We had two single beds and a closet. You know, it was like a big co-op dorm room where you had a general living area with the bathroom and stuff, and then you had your little dorm room. So I didn't think it was that bad. You know, other teams that possibly were used to living, you know, high on the hog, you know, may have thought it was terrible, but, you know, I thought it was okay. You know, I learned to adapt very early in life. You know, I came from parents that grew up during the Depression, and we made do.
Mm-hmm. All right,
and
well,
not like the dream teams today that, you know, they have to have all this, all that. You know, it's a lot different than it was in the 60s.
Sure. Sure. Well, did you participate in the opening ceremonies? I mean,
yes, I did not. The first opening ceremonies I ever saw in the Olympic Games were in Atlanta.
Oh.
And we participated, but we waited outside the stadium forever. We waited village to get on the buses forever. It was like a 10-hour day standing. It was unbelievable. You know, I think a lot of track athletes did not because they were running the next day. But since the swimmers weren't swimming until a week later, you know, we participated. And, you know, we didn't get to see any of the opening performances. I had no clue that that's what they did. I just thought, okay, why are we waiting so long? And no drinks, very few bathrooms available. You know, the conditions were not, and it was hot. And we were at 7,000-foot altitude in long-sleeve polyester dresses, stockings, high heels that none of us wear. You know, they weren't big, but they were bigger than our bare feet that we were used to walking in, you know, 12 months out of the year. So, you know, conditions for the athletes during opening ceremonies was not that great.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, just for everyone to know, what were the events that you ended up participating in Mexico City?
The 200 freestyle, 400 freestyle, and 800 meters freestyle.
Okay. Just describe those competitions once you got there. I mean, did everything go just about as according to plan? I mean, you already mentioned how you were sick, but just as far as the other athletes and as far as your performance, did everything come out? I mean, did you expect to get gold medals in all those?
I think that, you know, at that point in time, I was the world record holder in all of those events. The one that I was worried about the most was the 200 freestyle. I was, you know, like a body length ahead on my teammates in the other events, or in the 400 or in the 800, I was at least a half a pool length to three quarters of a pool length ahead of the other swimmers. And the 203 was a sprint for me because my favorite events were the 4, the 8, and the 15, and of course they didn't have the 1500. And so it was just, you know, it was a hard race. It was the hardest race I had ever swum in my life. And it was only like the fifth time I had ever swum that race, so it was new to me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they went. And, you know, I only won by a couple tenths. That was very close, very close.
So after you completed all three competitions, you had three gold medals. Did you do anything afterwards to celebrate, or?
No. I saw my parents, and that was a good thing. I went. I actually went back to their hotel that night and spent the night at their hotel. And I did for the next couple days there, and then went back to the dorms.
Okay.
I did get to spend time with my parents, which was really cool.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because I had been gone. You know, I hadn't seen them in over a month. So, it was a real special time.
Well, how would you describe your relationships with your teammates on the U.S. team? I mean, was it overall a close group? Do you all still stay in contact?
Oh, yeah, we still stay in contact. We all got along fine, you know. Nobody dissed anybody, as the term goes today. Nobody ignored their friends. It was a little different on the guys' side. Everybody picked on Mark Spitz, but on the girls' side, we were all friends, and we stay in touch when we can. Now with Facebook, we've gotten in touch with more. I stay in touch with Katie, my roommate in Mexico. We Christmas cards, email back and forth once in a while, talk on the phone. And Jane Swaggerty, a backstroker. I just played in a golf tournament with her last April in Phoenix. So, we try and stay in touch. And we had a reunion at the '08 trials. And I think probably about 15 or 16 of us were there, so that was great. When I used to work for Speedo, I traveled around the country, so if I knew where one of my teammates was living, we'd get in touch. So when I was working and traveling, that helped too, and, I was able to stay in touch. And I coach swimming now, so I'm able to see a few more here and there around the country when I travel.
Great to hear.
Yeah, so it was a special part of our lives. The chances of making an Olympic team are slim and none. So it's, we have a special bond, and I'm sure someone has told you our mantra: once an Olympian, always an Olympian, never former, never past.
Right.
So, we're family. Even if we don't know people from other teams, we're still a family.
That's good to hear. Well, gender verification testing was introduced during the 1968 games. Did you experience that? And
Oh yeah. In fact, a very funny story is, I was nervous about not passing it because I hadn't started menstruating yet. And so I got worried that I wouldn't pass the test because I really didn't know what it involved or know that much about it. And so my coach, to put my mind at ease, he goes, "God, Debbie, I'll get you tested now because you have nothing to worry about." So I went in, took a test, but as it turned out, there were a few Russians that did, pull out of the games prior to them because of the gender testing. We also had drug testing, too.
Well, you mentioned the Russian athletes. Did you have much interaction with the members of the Soviet bloc, and just what were your experiences?
No, we did not. In fact, they were pretty adamant that they got the pool by themselves and that nobody from the Western countries could come in during their practices.
So, yeah, just Overall, just a very distant impression from.
Yeah. No communication. You know, we would nod our head. Of course, there's a language barrier. More people speak English now than they did then. So, you know, there was always a language barrier. But with the westernized teams and, you know, the Swedes, the French, you know, we would try and communicate through hand signals, gestures, things of that nature.
All right. Let's see. Well, yeah, you mentioned that drug testing was introduced in Mexico City as well. Did you remember, you know, hearing any rumors about other athletes or teams that were using performance-enhancing drugs?
It wasn't until after the games that, you know, you've got to remember the average age of our American girls team was 16 3/4 years old. So, you know, we really didn't hear of any of that, you know, in our circle, in the swimming world. You know, afterwards, you know, we commented, wow, that track guy's big, you know, things like that. But, you know, we didn't think of steroids at the time. The one thing we did hear of is, you know, under the table payments for a lot of track athletes.
Right. Okay. Well, turning to another subject, Smith and Carlos's Black Power salute is just one of the enduring symbols in all of the Olympic history from there in Mexico City. So I know you said earlier that, you know, being 16 at the time, you know, you didn't really pay attention to a lot of, you know, world events and things like that. But were you aware of what they did in the medal ceremony and what an uproar that caused?
Well, and I was at the bottom of our apartment complex. There, they had TVs where you could go down and watch the events. And I became friends with Wyoming Tyus, Barbara Farrell, and Madeline Manning. They were all down there watching the events because it was raining. They weren't going to go out and watch the track and field in the rain, so they would watch it on TV. And it was during the 200 that, you know, I was down there and they were watching. And I heard them commenting, you know, that Harry Edwards had tried to get them to do the salute, this, that, and the other, and they weren't going to be a part of it. They said, no, we're not going to do that at this time and place. So I was aware of what had happened. But, you know, as I said, you know, I had just turned 16, and my summer life was swimming prior to that. And, you know, I was removed from that. You know, we were in a society that swimming at that time was kind of a middle-class sport. So we weren't aware of that. We didn't have any blacks in the sport at that time that could afford swimming. And it was just, you know, track and field was kind of their forte as well as basketball, beginning into basketball at that time. So we didn't have much interaction with the black athletes and how they felt. It was at the games that, you know, it came to light.
Were you at the time? Were you aware of the media coverage of that issue? I mean, did you pick up on any of that?
No, I was not.
Okay.
You know, I did not notice. You know, they put out a little paper every day, and it wasn't until afterwards. And it was just a, you know, a picture in the paper that circulated around the games. And but I had no clue the reaction in the press in the States.
Okay, well, looking back on it, I mean, just what are your reflections on it now, given, like, just the IOC's response and the treatment that Smith and Carlos received later once they got back to the U.S.?
Well, You know, the whole ideal, when you become an Olympic athlete and you have to sign all these papers and contracts, more or less, and code of ethics for the games. Like, I signed a paper saying that I was never a bathhouse attendant or received any money for being a bathhouse attendant or teaching swimming lessons, anything to do with swimming, you know, or you would be disqualified because you would be a professional. You signed a code of conduct type thing and a statement saying all this stuff, that you would adhere to the rules of the Olympic Games, that it was a non-political event, yada, yada, yada. So, you know, they signed those papers, or you sign them or you don't participate. So, you know, they knew they were breaking the rules of, you know, the Olympic Charter, the Olympic Code, and everything else. So, you know, they were made, God, what's the word I'm looking for? Senior moment here. You know, they were made as the bad guy, and they were sent home because of that, because they broke the rule. You know, they just didn't get a slap on the hand and say, okay, you were wrong, you know, like, don't do it again. So, you know, their careers and their reputations were tarnished because of that. And it followed them, and, you know, I know them today, and they are awesome gentlemen. You know, I played golf with them, been to functions with them, and they realized what they did. And yes, it did put it on the map, and it did bring it to light, but, you know, they know with that backlash that they got because of it, you know, maybe it was not the thing to do at that place at time. You know, it just, they're great gentlemen today. I enjoy, whenever I run across them, we sit down and talk, and I enjoy their acquaintance and friendship.
That's good to hear. Well, just moving on, you described how you were really shy at this point in your life. And so just, you know, did you have much interaction with the media, even with you winning?
Too much interaction with the media.
Okay.
You know, the first question I got in the interview room after the Olympics, after my first event, was, do you think the guys are in Vietnam are proud of you? You know, boom. And I distinctly remember my answer was, I hope they're as proud of me as I am of them. And, you know, all the USOC said was, avoid any political questions. And boom, and that's all they said, and that was the first thing they said to me, the first question asked. And, you know, I had friends in Vietnam at that time, swimmers that I used to swim with at Arden Hills in Sacramento that were over there. So it, you know, I was aware of what was going on there. I didn't mean I agreed with it. We'd been in Vietnam since 1952. You know, people thought it was in the 60s. The day I was born, my uncle dropped my mom off, because my dad was in Korea. My uncle dropped my mom off at the Naval Academy, and he was waiting at the Chesapeake Bay Bridge for the governor to cut the ribbon to open the bridge so he could go to Dover to get on a plane to go to Vietnam to help the Vietnamese and the French learn how to use tanks.
Wow.
So, we were involved very early on there.
Right.
Because my uncle was a major in the Army, and he was in Patton's division over in Europe during World War II.
Okay.
So, you know, it just, I was not comfortable with them around me because I didn't think I was doing anything spectacular. I was doing stuff I loved to do, which was swimming and competing.
Yeah. Well, while you were there in Mexico City, just in between your competitions, did you go to any other events and watch other athletes perform?
No, I didn't. The only thing, because, see, the week before, we were the second week, remember, I was still training. I was still working out and practicing. I still had two practices a day. So we didn't get to see, you know, we get up in the morning, we go to a pool, we travel and go, either go to the Olympic pool or we go to the training pool that they had somewhere else around the city. So we travel an hour because of the traffic was atrocious there. You know, they didn't really have freeways or anything. So, you know, we would sit on a bus forever going to training. And I also had sprained my ankle the day I left for Mexico City. So after I'd finished training, I'd come back to the village, go to the trainer, get worked on my ankle, and then go back, have lunch, go back to the room, you know, take a nap or something, and then head back and train again. You know, the ones that did get to see other events were people that possibly swam one event or they were there and were alternates on the team. And, you know, so, it was a little more difficult for me. I had three events, and they were spread out during the entire time. And I had distance events, so, you know, I was not a sprinter. I still trained quite a bit.
Okay, well,
I did get to see a little volleyball because we had to walk through the volleyball arena to get to the pool.
Okay. Well, before we move on, I mean, are there any other memorable or interesting events or experiences from the 68 games that you just wanted to share?
Let's see. The first week that I was there when I was on crutches and I was taking ice back to my room to ice my ankle before I went to bed and stuff. I ran into Sherm, my personal coach and the Olympic coach and the assistant coach, Frank Elm. And we were sitting there talking and the ice in the little Pixie cup was melting. So I kind of shook it to get the water out. The ice flew out, hit Frank square in between the eyes, and he ended up having to have butterfly stitches on his head because I nailed him good. But other than that, you know, not a whole lot. You know, I was living my life like I was living my life at home. As I said, I really did not, it was a swim meet to me. I did not really understand the importance of what I was doing at that point in my life, competing in the Olympic Games.
Hmm.
And I still don't realize a whole lot what I accomplished. At the Olympic trials in 2008 in Omaha, watching the swimmers and realizing, wow, I did this 40 years ago, but let me tell you, it was a spectacular event. It was an event. At our Olympic trials, we were lucky if we had 20 people in the stands, not 8,000.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I didn't realize what the Olympic Games really were at that point in time.
Okay. So for you personally, with all the different topics we've covered about the 68 games, for you personally, what stands out for you as the most memorable part now of having competed in Mexico City?
When I won the 800 free, after ceremonies were over, after everybody was exiting, you know, I was standing on the pool deck with Sherm, my coach, Frank Elm, the assistant coach, and I can't remember if George Haynes was there as well. We were all talking, and I took my medal out of the box, and I put it around Sherm's neck, and I said, "Sherm, this one's yours." He goes, "No, no, no, no." I said, "No." I said, "I could not have made it here without you." And so I gave it to him.
Wow. That's quite a story. Okay, well, let's move on. You know, after the Olympics, what was life like for you right after you got back? I mean, did you just go back to school all over again? And what was your athletic career from that point on?
I was one of the six athletes that was selected to march in the closing ceremonies. And I... when all the athletes broke loose out of the stands, once we had marched around and we were standing in our areas for the closing ceremonies, Mike Burton, my teammate, came up and stood next to me. And I did not know at that time that Sherm said, "Mike, you get over the railing and you get next to her and you keep an eye on her and you protect her." You know, Sherm was my second father. You know, my dad, 11 months after we moved to Sacramento, he was transferred again, and this time to Modesto, which was 75 miles south of Sacramento. So he commuted between Modesto and Sacramento every day. And Sherm more or less became my second father because, you know, my dad was on the road and at work all the time. So, and I actually spent more time with Sherm than I did with my dad. So, and I was, you know, I was 16, I was naive. So, Sherm just made sure I was protected because he knew what was going to happen. And he wanted to make sure, you know, I came home. So anyway, Mike and I stood there, and when they put out the Olympic flame up on the big jumbotron at that time, it said Munich 72, and we looked at each other and said, "We'll be there." And I had every intention of going to Munich and repeating what I had done in Mexico City because I loved swimming. I had fun at the games. I enjoyed it. I loved, you know, working out. And it was my life, and that's what I wanted to do. Well, when I got back to school, I had already missed 2 months of school. So I had a lot of catching up to do. And then, you know, people would whisper behind my back, "Oh, there goes Timmy, da-da-da-da." Well, I'll back up a little bit. When we arrived from Mexico City, it was almost like the whole town had, and they closed school for the day. And they took buses of students out to the airport and, you know, our band from the high school, because our high school had Johnny Ferris, myself, Susie Peterson. We had four athletes there that went to the Olympic Games.
And, Not bad.
There was a band there. There was a parade, you know, from the airport. And it was a brand new airport. It had only been open a year. So there was a parade downtown, through the main streets, or along the Capitol, everything. And, you know, it was kind of a cool thing, now that I think about it. Then I was embarrassed. Why do people want to see me? So, you know, and kids would whisper, "There goes Debbie, there goes Debbie," and this, that, and the other. And you know, I didn't like the attention. I didn't want the attention. So I'm plugging in a charger on my phone.
Oh, no problem.
Okay, just, you know, we still have a little bit to go, but I want to make sure I have enough battery.
Okay, yeah, thank you. So, yeah, I mean, you're 16 years old at the time, so what was your athletic career moving forward from that point?
I actually took a couple weeks off from training, and I was on what I would call the roast beef, mashed potato, and peas circuit for the next 2 years. Because those 2 years out of 18 months, months of school, I only went to school 9 months. You know, I was traveling to Europe, I went to Australia, you know, Japan, all around. I would go all across the country, people would have me speak, this, that, and the other. So my training wasn't, when I swam hard, but it was not as consistent as it was the first 6 months after the Olympic Games. Was, I didn't train as much as I normally had at that point in the year. You know, I was already behind time. I normally would have trained, you know, starting in September. Well, I didn't really start training until November, and nationals were in April. I did not do that great the first nationals. You know, people that hadn't gone to the games had been training a lot, and they were, okay, we want to beat Debbie type situation, which is normal. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. I knocked somebody else off. I was at the, you know, king of the mountain. It was time to knock me off. So they were hungry, and I was trying to get back into the groove, and I did for the next couple of years. And then January of 72, I went to a swim meet, and I swam a 500 freestyle, which is one of the events that I love. I didn't have fun. I didn't enjoy it at all. I didn't like the competition. I didn't like the racing. And the next morning, I didn't swim the second day, just the first day. And that Monday morning, we didn't have practice. That Monday afternoon, I got in, and I had Sherma's down at the other pool with Terry Drinkwater, because they were setting up an interview about Mark Spitz at the time. And I was swimming, and I got out, and I thought, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm done. So I got out of the water. I got dressed. And I was leaving, and Sherm said, where are you going? And I waved. And by the time I got home, which was a mile away, Sherm had called my mom and said, Debbie quit swimming. She goes, how do you know? He goes, I just know. She's on her way home. And I got home, and my mom said, you know, she said, what's up? I said, I'm quit. She goes, why? And we sat and talked for like 2 or 3 hours about it. And I had wanted to quit a couple of years before that. But when I started talking about it, I started crying. And I was getting too emotional, then I won't be able to do this, that, and the other. And I knew I wasn't ready to quit at that time. But this time, you know, not a tear dropped, and I knew I was ready to walk away from it.
Mm.
And, you know, I don't have any regrets. The one thing I do regret is that they didn't really have college swimming for women then,
right?
Because I was almost 20 at the time, and there, you know, there were some AIAW teams, but you know, when 50s and 100s, I was a distance swimmer.
Yeah.
You know, I did swim in junior college because I was doing 25s and 50s, and you know, that it was fun because it was different, but you know, that's not what I swam. So it didn't work for me.
Were the people around you, your coaches, your teammates, your family, were they supportive and understanding?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I started swimming some different events as well. I started swimming the 400 IM. I won the Nationals a couple times. I started swimming the 200 Fly. And I didn't win, but I made finals. So, you know, and I had broken some world records, and I had dropped times and set American records. So, you know, it was there, but I was just done mentally at that time because it really wasn't, you know, it wasn't as fun.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people I swam with had stopped swimming. So that's, you know, why I quit. I just, you know, it wasn't a challenge for me. I guess is a good way of putting it. I wasn't challenged by it.
Okay, well, now we'll just ask, I guess, some more reflective questions just about the 68 game. So, first, I mean, just what, you know, when you look back on it, what has the 68 games, what impact has that had just on your life? Has it, you know, overall been positive? I mean, just what do you take away from it now?
It gave me a lot of opportunities. I didn't pursue all of them, but it did give me a lot of opportunities, and the ones that I got, I ran with. The ones that I chose, I ran with. I got to work with CBS Sports Spectacular. I got to work with ESPN at the Munich Games. I wrote some articles for AP, so I got to swim this, see the swimming events. I went over to Munich to watch the games. I had a place to stay, and I had a ticket to Munich, but I had no way of getting into the games. So Bob Paul, who was director of communications at that time, media and communications, media relations, got me a job with Associated Press. So I got to go get into the village. I got to get in to see events. So that was really cool. And 68 opened the doors for that. What else occurred? You know, I didn't get college scholarships because they didn't have that for women. I started teaching swimming lessons. I got to travel around the world. You know, how many people at 16 back in the 60s got to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Not many. So, and the people I've met, you know, the friendships that have developed because of it. That's what I value and treasure most.
Okay. What is one piece of advice you would give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Cherish the moment. Cherish the moment. You're a special person for being there, becoming an Olympian. Cherish it, value it, and live by the Olympic creed and standard and code. It just, you know, it's, you're a special person because of it, and just cherish the moment.
That's good advice. So what is this oral history project? I mean, what does this mean to you and your family? Because we've gotten some different responses just from some of the other Olympians that we've interviewed. So just what do you hope to see this project accomplish, and what does it mean to you?
Well, to realize what the Olympics have become and what they were, because they're not the same. They're definitely not the same. But also, if the Olympics, the way of putting them on today and the political world today, if Uberoth had not made it as commercial as he did getting sponsors to host the Olympics themselves and the TV coverage, if that had not materialized as to what it was today, I think the Olympics would have died. I don't think a city or an organization, because that's how the Olympics are awarded to a city, not a country, I do not think they would have survived, because I don't think anybody could have afforded to put them on. I don't like the dollar sign involved today that the athletes receive. You know, they're considered amateur. They're not amateur athletes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the amateur athletes are athletes number, you know, 10, 11, 12, all the way down to the age grouper. You know, the top athletes in the world are professionals. They're getting paid for their performances, and they're using their money to train. You know, Dara Torres is a professional athlete. But that's the way the Olympics have trained. So this project takes it back into perspective of how well athletes of my generation performed without what they have today. And I hope it makes them appreciate the infancy of the Olympics back in the 60s.
Hmm. Okay. Well, is there anything else you want to tell us about that maybe we didn't cover?
You know, you've covered a lot. You've brought back a lot of memories because of
this. Oh, good. Well, that's what we're shooting for.
Well, and you know, my father, bless his heart, is still alive. He's 87, and he's a World War II vet in the Pacific Theater, and he was pre-Iwo Jima, and he was a Marine, and you know, Tom Brokaw did an awesome job of bringing out the greatest generation. And I just wish my father would bring out a little bit more, because he'll tell stories. I wish you would write it down. I wish you would tape record your stories of what you do, because, you know, his memory's starting to fail a little bit. But, you know, what you're doing with this project is great. You're getting people for senior. I just really said to it.
Well, it's definitely our pleasure. So if there's nothing any more for you to add, I think that'll conclude. So I will stop recording. And, Debbie, we thank you so much.
Oh, well, you're